And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Doug Peacock. For decades, he's been a naturalist, an author, a defender of wilderness areas. That calling developed especially after his military service in Vietnam. After the war, when Doug returned to the United States, he found that solitude in the wilderness was exactly what he needed to work through his wartime experiences. In fact, he credits grizzly bears with restoring his soul. He's best known for his book, Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness. It's a memoir of his experiences in the 70s and 80s, much of which was spent alone in the wilderness of the western U.S. observing grizzly bears. His other books include Walking It Off, A Veteran's Chronicle of War and Wilderness, that one from 2005, The Essential Grizzly, The Mingled Fates of Men and Bears from 2006. Doug will be the keynote speaker at the Nahant Marsh Education Center's second annual Oberholzer Awards. That's on February 29th. IPR is one of the sponsors of this year's event, taking place in East Moline on February 29th. The Oberholzer Awards were started to recognize local people who have dedicated their lives or will dedicate their lives to protecting our natural world. Doug Peacock joins us by phone. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Hi, Ben. It's a pleasure.
Well, I know you currently really like to talk about the threat of climate change. Before we do that, I wonder if I could ask you to take us back to your life after returning from Vietnam. Perhaps give us a snapshot of your military service, what it was like, and how your passion for the wilderness began when you returned to the U.S.
Well, I was a Green Beret medic in Vietnam in the Central Highlands, in what used to be the northern part of South Vietnam, and living with indigenous people, mountain yards mostly. But indeed, the war got there, and I stayed for two tours through the Tet Offensive. And during the Tet Offensive, as medic for 3,000 or 4,000 people, the closest thing I'd ever see to a doctor, you know, I had to handle mass casualties. And I was just too close to too much collateral damage, you know, that cowardly phrase we use when there's a bad airstrike and there's a pile of pieces of small bodies. And So once I came back to the States, I really wasn't able to be around people. And the one place I've always been comfortable is the wilderness. You know, I grew up in Michigan, and my boyhood wild places were swamps and river bottoms and woods. And so I was quite comfortable being, you know, by myself if necessary in the wildest country I could find. So when I came back in the spring of 1968, I was in the Rocky Mountains by then, and I just started camping out. And as the snows melted, I went north into the Wind River Range of Wyoming, where I had a malaria attack. And coming out of the high mountains to deal with the malaria attack, I went to Yellowstone, which is a flatter place with better weather. And I went to, and I knew the country, and I went into a hot spring area where I was planning on soaking in the hot springs, you know, the notion of hot spring spas and just healing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a whale of a paroxysm of a malaria attack there and went out of my head for about a day and a half. And after that, I was sitting in a hot creek. Now, this is, you know, in Yellowstone, a lot of thermal features. So there is a little creek that comes out of a very hot spring and ends up tepid, dumping into a major river. And so you can go up and down and kind of, you know, find little bathtubs. And I was soaking in there one cold October day with the hot water running over my neck. And by that time, I'd spent a summer in Alaska, but I really didn't know anything about grizzly bears. You know, I might have seen one or two at a distance, but I didn't know anything about them. And so I'm sitting there with the hot water running over my neck, and I kind of look off to my right, and there's a mother grizzly with two big yearling cubs. And she's, you know, 200 feet away across this meadow. And, you know, she's not looking at me, but I don't know anything about bears. And the only thing I know is you're not supposed to get close to mothers with cubs.
Right.
And so I decided I decided I was going to climb a tree. You know, there's a little lodgepole forest up and down the Yellowstone country all over the place. And right in the bank of this hot spring, just 4 or 5 feet away, was a lodgepole pine. And I decided when the bears weren't looking in my direction, I was going to climb that damn tree. So they looked away. I stood up, and immediately from the whirlpool-like effects of the hot water blacked out. And it didn't matter. I was so terrified. I grabbed the tree anyway, and I hit it with my head and tore a gash in my forehead, and the blood just running down my face. But I'm so scared. I get to the top of this tree anyway. And I get to the top of this tree, and I look around, and I realize the tree that I've climbed isn't much bigger than a Christmas tree.
Oh, no. So,
yeah. And so, you know, this mother grizzly and her two yearlings, they wandered around pretending to graze, sometimes coming. They knew I was up there. They wouldn't give me the dignity to look at me, you know. And I sat up there for 40 minutes, you know, blue from the cold, bleeding, naked as a newt, feeling like some species of silly sparrow, you know, at the top of this Christmas tree. So those bears, they got my attention, and that was the beginning.
Yes, and you've had how many encounters, even close, much closer encounters with grizzlies? Do you feel like you, in the meantime, after studying grizzlies, tracking grizzlies, being in their presence, do you understand grizzly bears, what it's like from their vantage point? Was that a goal of yours?
Well, it had to be. Otherwise, you could really get in trouble. And it's not just you that, you know, if you're involved in a bear mauling, they're going to take it out on a bear, too. So, you know, I made sure I learned quickly enough about grizzlies. And in the beginning, I got charged by, you know, two or three dozen grizzlies, mostly mothers with cubs. Now, you know, a mother grizzly doesn't give a damn about you as long as you're no threat to her cub. Mm. And that's just universal. You know, and, you know, all that advice about if we ever get hit by a grizzly bear, play dead. It's good advice. Tough to do. But,
to play,
you know,
dead and just let them, what, they sniff you?
No, you know, if a bear is going to touch you, you should, and that's never happened to me. Two dozen bears do a partial charge and then just veer off or skid to a stop. One grizzly mother, and this was entirely my fault, charged me and skidded to a stop and ended up about really close, maybe 6 feet away. And then she leaned forward and pretended to, or appeared to sniff my pant leg. But, you know, like just the summer before last now, I took my daughter, who saw a lot of grizzly bears in her growing up, into our last hike in Yellowstone before I walked her down the aisle. And we were sitting up on top of a windy butte in Yellowstone National Park and huddled behind a giant glacier erratic boulder. And all of a sudden, we're kind of just crouched, huddled up and cuddled up, and I could see the expression in my daughter's face change. And I looked beyond her, and there is a mother grizzly with a single yearling cub. And the bear hasn't heard us because of the wind. She comes over a rise, and the bear's only 50, 60 feet away. That's way too close. However, you know, this grizzly, the only thing I say is, don't move. And the mother grizzly goes through all the things that a mother grizzly will when, you know, there might be a danger around. She rears, stands on her hind legs, she looks around. That's just to see better and smell. And, you know, you can see that she's agitated by, you know, her mouth was kind of slobbers and she chomps her jaws. But after 3 or 4 minutes, the mother grizzly calms down and she and her yearling cub, it's early June, which is the mating season for grizzlies, walks right past us. I mean, like 20 feet away. Mm. And we don't move a muscle. I got my arm around my daughter or huddled against this rock. She walks to the edge of the cliff. And she's just barely out of view behind a little tree, a little pine tree. And all of a sudden, I can hear the sound of nursing, which is a sputtering sound. And it just doesn't happen very much. I mean, I've been hanging out with grizzlies for half a century. And, you know, you only get to hear that three or four times. She was comfortable enough to nurse her cub, you know, 30 feet away from us for 7 or 8 minutes.
She was fully aware that you and your daughter
absolutely.
Were...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, she walked, you know, the cub would try to come a little closer than he should have because he was curious like a puppy.
Wow.
But,
oh.
You know, I knew from the beginning that we were okay. The grizzly recognized that, too. And in the distance, I could hear the bellowing of a mating pair of grizzlies, you know. And they're quite vocal during the very brief mating season of early June. And that meant a male grizzly was around there. Now, for a mother grizzly, a male grizzly is the biggest threat to her cub. And you see that kind of behavior. I mean, she nursing her cub next to it. You see it often up on salmon streams. I've had, you know, Alaska, British Columbia. I had a mother grizzly come and leave her three cubs sitting next to me on the bank. Well, I'm not moving or doing anything. She goes out and gets the salmon and comes back and collects her cubs. And, you know, the popular thinking behind that is male big grizzlies tend to avoid humans, and so we're safer.
Wow. Doug, we've only got about 10 minutes left. I could listen to you talk about grizzlies all
day. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sort of a BSer, but yes.
I don't think it's BS, but I know what you mean. Now, these males can get to be 500-600 pounds. When they stand up, they're over 6 feet tall. So I have the feeling that with your background as a Green Beret medic, not a lot of people can be in the presence of these creatures and keep their cool, which you have many, many times. I want to devote some time, because I know another passion of yours more recently is the concern about climate change that you have. What is your message from someone who has spent so much time tracking, certainly not killing, grizzly bears and other really amazing animals about climate change?
Well, climate change is the beast of our time. And, you know, there's an overlap there. The greatest threat to Yellowstone's grizzlies, that's where I live, and that's the population I'm most trying to save by connecting it with northern grizzly bears. But climate change is the biggest threat to grizzlies. It's already killed off the five-needle pine that produces the nut that Yellowstone's grizzlies, it was their most important food for millennia. But on the endangered species list now, everything has changed. It's incredibly, it's terrifying if you have children, and I have a granddaughter now. But, you know, the list of endangered animals includes everything on Earth, including the upright ape. You know, Homo sapiens are not going to be exempt for this one. And as early as this summer, I expect California-style wildfires to hit the Rocky Mountains. It's just a matter of last year we had a very snowy winter, and if it doesn't snow some more this winter, but it's really, I just wonder about modern humans. You know, the thing driving all of this seems to be just human greed, and we're like a culture with Asperger's. You know, we're brilliant. We can solve any technical or logistical problem. We know how to make money, but we lack empathy. And, you know, I think I'm going to fight to the end of my days against climate change, doing everything I can. But, in fact, part of it is just looking at the unvarnished truth out there and start living your life.
Why do you think? What are your thoughts, Doug, on why you said unvarnished truth? Why do we not face it as a society, especially here in the United States? It's such a subject of controversy, despite the science that is unequivocal.
Yeah, and I think it's what I said. Like somebody with Asperger's disease, we don't have empathy. Empathy for, you know, the Bangladeshi farmer or anybody in the third world whose effects are, you know, Australia is just the beginning. I also work in conservation in South Africa and, or, you know, like Botswana. and it's there, and it's going to sweep up, and eventually grains will fail in Asia, and that means China. And people are not just going to stay in one place and starve. They're going to go north into Siberia, where Lord knows what's going to happen with the nuclear powers. But they'll fight it out one way or another. That endangers everybody. But the meanwhile, the thing to watch are the ice sheets in Antarctica and the lack of sea ice in the northern Arctic. Yeah. And I have another project to create a national park up there. It's actually already done on the Beaufort Sea in the Yukon, working with Native Inuit people. And already the permafrost is boiling methane out of it everywhere, across Siberia, across the Yukon and Alaska. Methane initially is a greenhouse gas that's up to 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide. It has a shorter half-life. But,
right.
That's scary.
Right. Yeah, Doug, and you give so many talks as a naturalist, an author, specializing in so many areas of wilderness, and to all age groups. I wonder, you've mentioned your granddaughter now a couple of times here. You must speak to younger groups too. You're going to fight, you say, till the end of your days, but it must be really a sensation to look at young faces at what's in their future.
Well, I sometimes pull my punches with high school students. They don't need to hear that. What we need to do is live fully every day and arm yourself with friendship and love the earth. And, nature is such a solace. There's so much beauty in the world, and we can find that every day. And we will go on into this together, and we'll fight together, and we'll love one another. And, that's not the worst thing that can happen.
Mm-hmm. Here in Iowa, talking about climate change, we're looking at more frequent severe weather due to climate change in the Midwest. What about you in Montana, where you live there near Yellowstone?
It's wildfire, simple as that. The way they hit California last year, well, those conditions are increasingly possible in the northern Rockies. And I'm talking about Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. Wildfires, the huge ones, have a life of their own. There's nothing we can do to stop them. And, prescribed trimming and logging and burns are a hoax. They really are not going to make any difference. And we need to prepare ourselves for that hard truth. It's coming, and maybe a lot sooner than anybody thinks. And these changes are all abrupt. They don't take place. Every time somebody tells you centuries, just substitute decades. And I'm not even sure we have decades to mass on a collective scale.
We're coming to the end of this conversation. We're going way, way in a dark place. Where is the hope then, Doug?
I think that the hope is in living a really productive life and fighting for the things you know that everyone's going to need, no matter what happens, no matter how dark the sky is. And that, for me, that's preserving wilderness. Wilderness is the original homeland of Homo sapiens. All our intelligence was evolved, in the Pleistocene, and whose remnants today we'd call the wilderness. And the same thing with my grizzly bears. What habitat do they need most? Well, the stuff that most closely resembles wilderness. And so that's my small effort to preserve a place where, hopefully things can survive. I don't know about evolve. The rate of change that's going on now is perhaps as much as 10,000 times the rate of organic evolution. We can't adapt to this kind of change in temperatures.
Doug, we've got a couple minutes left, and I wanted to pose this to you in the final minute or two we have of our conversation. It's been such a delight, and your life has been so magnificent from growing up in Michigan, being a Green Beret medic, two tours of duty in Vietnam, and then your whole career dedicated to preserving wilderness and with grizzlies. Can you, in closing, Doug Peacock, describe for me in a bit of detail a perfect day for you? What would you wish if you could wake up tomorrow? Maybe each of your days are nearly perfect. What is Doug Peacock's perfect day?
Well, I've had a bunch of them. I'm just a lucky sucker. Now I'm down in the Sonoran Desert. And being out, I buried Ed Abbey, my old friend, about 100 miles to the west of me. And journeying out to his grave in this beautiful low desert is an incredible day. And when I get back home, the grizzlies will emerge from their dens. And I've got a favorite hill in a thermal area. It's wild, but there's steam vents and hot springs all over. And the buffalo die there in the wintertime. And the grizzlies come in the spring and feed on them. And I just sit up there looking out at this huge expanse of meadow, waiting for the grizzly to come in and take his turn with the wolves at the buffalo carcass. And I don't have to do much. I don't have to be very active to have a perfect day. That, you know, the beauty of nature is always there. In Yellowstone, you're gifted with the presence of bison. You know, the buffalo that almost went extinct, when in 1902 they could only count 23 wild animals left in Yellowstone Park. And their great-grandchildren are there every day, and I love their company. Their kinship gives me great pleasure.
We have received so much pleasure from your conversation to Iowa Public Radio listeners. Doug Peacock, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Bannon, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Doug Peacock, naturalist, author, Vietnam veteran. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you so much for joining us.